Brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Gary Cousins. The theme for Brother Cousins' classes this week is Nehemiah, Spiritual Lessons in Challenging Times. And today's class is entitled Spiritual Leadership. Brother Gary.
Well, good morning, brethren and sisters. Whoa, must be Friday morning. Sorry, Saturday morning, last day of Bible school. A little rough this morning. We will finish on time this morning because I will not be late to the teenage class today. Because yesterday, the first speaker went a little over, and the first speaker was late to the teenage class, and the teenagers were waiting for me to arrive, and they were all sitting in their seats and the door was closed, and as soon as I walked through, they all said, "You're late." And when they're late, I make them do either push-ups or they have to get in front of the class and sing a song. So I had to do push-ups in front of the teenagers yesterday, and I'm not doing that again today. So today's class is a bit of a summary class. We are going to build on some of the points that we've already made. And the objective for today's class is to take some of the characteristics that we've seen regarding Nehemiah and how he conducted himself and paint a picture of Nehemiah as a spiritual leader. And I have a confession to make this morning. Brother Gary Sunt's pointer I have misplaced. So it's not in my case, and I'm sure it's around, but we're going to have to go without the pointer this morning. So, Gary, I apologize. I will find it. So these are the areas that we're going to look at. We're going to look at Nehemiah as a strategist and a visionary. We're going to look at Nehemiah as a motivator of people. We're going to look at some of the positive communication patterns that he displays as he deals with some of the issues and some of the people. We're also going to look at how Nehemiah deals with confrontation, and in particular, how he manages his emotions, in particular his anger. And then, if we have time at the end, we're going to look at how he manages opposition and what kind of patterns exist in how he addresses the opposition. So we're going to begin then by looking at Nehemiah as a strategist and a visionary. Somebody who is a visionary has the ability to see potential despite reality. And not only the ability to just see potential, but to communicate it. And to communicate it so convincingly to others that his vision becomes theirs. A visionary has the ability to see potential and to communicate it so convincingly to others that the potential becomes their vision as well, their shared vision. And we all need to have a vision for our ecclesia, don't we? What does an ideal ecclesia look like? What do we need to do in our ecclesia to achieve the vision that we have for where the ecclesia needs to get to? And if we don't have a vision for our ecclesia is just maintaining the status quo, isn't it? Our ecclesia is just going through the motions. They're just, you know, going through life day in and day out. Ecclesial life, you know, one day right after another. Our ecclesia cannot be growing, our ecclesia cannot be expanding, our ecclesia cannot be developing unless we have a vision for where it needs to go next. And that's what Nehemiah was so incredibly good at. Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 1. We've already covered this, but we remind ourselves of the situation. And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. And we know what's going to happen, and we know that Nehemiah had just spent 4 months, right? Weeping and mourning and fasting and praying together with his God. And during that 4 months, what was Nehemiah doing? Aside from pleading on behalf of his people, he was working with his God to formulate a plan. God, what do you think about this? What if we did it this way? What if we did it that way? And he's refining the plan with God's help, and he's assessing the risks. Well, how are we going to handle the king? How am I going to go in and confront the king? What are the priorities going to be? And how am I going to develop the courage to do what I need to do in order to put that plan into effect? And so he comes before the king. And he says in verse 4, sorry, the king says to him in verse 4, Nehemiah, for what dost thou make request? And that's when he says that short little prayer, right? Well, this was Nehemiah's window of opportunity, and he knew it. Go back to Ezra chapter 4. In Ezra chapter 4, there's a letter from Artaxerxes to Ezra telling him to stop the work. But there's a window of opportunity in the letter, and we're not going to go through the whole letter because we don't want to take the time to do that this morning. But in Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 21, in Ezra chapter 4 and verse 21, here's Nehemiah's window of opportunity, right? Give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded, until another commandment shall be given from me. That's Nehemiah's window of opportunity, right? To work with the king to give another commandment. And so Nehemiah takes advantage of that opportunity, and so he prays to the God of heaven, Lord, give me strength, right? That short little prayer, the moment of time just before he approaches the king. Proverbs 6:3, verse 6, in all thy ways acknowledge him in everything by prayer and supplication. That's Nehemiah living in prayer. You remember from Monday's class. And so we read in verse 6, he makes his request to the king in verse 5. If it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, and thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And it would have seemed like an eternity before the king gave his answer. So the king says to me, and the queen was sitting by his side, he says, for how long shall thy journey be? When wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Nehemiah's prayer was answered. This was proof positive to Nehemiah, Proverbs 21, that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Nehemiah was able to find favor both in the sight of God and of man. And I'd like to suggest to you that this is a quote-unquote fulfillment, if you will, of Isaiah chapter 58. Turn, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 58. And I would like to suggest to you that Isaiah chapter 58 is actually a prophecy that relates to Nehemiah. In Isaiah chapter 58, we begin to read at verse 8, it says, then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thy health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, and satisfy the afflicted soul. And Nehemiah did all those things, didn't he? Right? He fed 150 people at his table every single day while they were building the wall. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday. Verse 11, and the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water whose waters fail not. Now look at verse 12. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. Certainly an allusion to Nehemiah. There certainly echoes back to what Nehemiah was able to accomplish there with the people in Jerusalem. And so when we come back to Nehemiah chapter 2, God employs Nehemiah here to be the repairer of the breach, so to speak, in the language of Isaiah chapter 58, to restore the paths for the people to dwell in Jerusalem. But the king doesn't just carte blanche say, yeah, go ahead, right? He's very specific. He says, yes, Nehemiah, you go ahead. But, he says, what did he want to know? How long would your journey be and when will you return? And so Nehemiah has to have the answers for the king, right? Those are the answers that he would have formulated during the 4 months that he was in prayer with his heavenly Father. And during that period of time, he would have developed a Gantt chart, right, with a timeline on it from the time he would have left the king until the time that he was going to return, and he would have had all the steps of the project all outlined. And so Nehemiah says, he says, I set him a time. He would have known that he needed secured passage, and so he asked the king in chapter 2 for letters to convey him over to Jerusalem. He would have needed supplies and materials, and so he asked for the king's help and supplies from the king's forest. And he would have needed security due to the hostility of the heathen nations around, and so he asked the king for captains and horsemen. He had a plan. He had a vision. He had it all mapped out, and he laid it out before the king, and he says, here's when I'm going to leave, and here's when I'm going to return. He was a strategist, and he was a visionary, wasn't he? And the people in Jerusalem needed somebody that could come back and lay that all out for them and motivate them to do it. And so he comes to Jerusalem. Right? He comes to Jerusalem in Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem, and he was there 3 days, and he came with no fanfare. You know, he came with this entourage of people from the king. I don't know how he kept it quiet, but he did. Right? And for 3 days, he told nobody that he was there. Verse 12 of Nehemiah chapter 2 says, and I arose in the night, I and some few men with me. Neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode upon. So he told no one. The wisdom of keeping our tongues. Psalm 141 says, set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. Keep the door of my lips. That's one of the things that Nehemiah was good at. He knew when to speak up and he knew when to be quiet. And so he comes to Jerusalem. Why didn't he tell the rulers? You know, it would have been a good thing to employ their help, wouldn't he? The rulers could have provided him tons of men and servants and all of that to help him out, right? Why didn't he tell them? Go to Ezra chapter 9 and verse 2. In Ezra chapter 9 and verse 2, there was evidently some trust issues with those who were ruling in Jerusalem. Verse 2 of Ezra 9. Here's a reprimand of the children of Israel. It says, for they have taken of their daughters for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers hath been chief in this trespass. So there was no integrity, was there, amongst the rulership back in Jerusalem? And then when we come over to Nehemiah chapter 6, Nehemiah chapter 6 in verse 17 to 19, verses we read back on Tuesday, it says, moreover, in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there was this marriage alliance in verse 18, and then in verse 19 it says, and they reported his, that is Tobiah's, good deeds before me. Tobiah didn't have a good deed in his body. And they uttered my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to me to put me in fear. And so there was a lack of trust, there was a lack of integrity with the rulers of the people, right? They had one foot in each camp. And so Nehemiah says, you know what, I'm not going to let them even know that I'm here, and I'm not going to tell them what I'm doing. And so he gets up in the middle of the night, and he walks around the city of Jerusalem. And he exits the city of Jerusalem through the valley gate. You see where that red dot is there. And he begins on a horse to go around the city of Jerusalem. And he gets to the fountain gate just over there on the bottom southeast, right? Southeast corner of the city at the fountain gate. And when he gets to the fountain gate, there's so much rubble, there's so much debris around the wall and around the city of Jerusalem that his horse can't go any further. So he has to dismount, and then he has to walk the rest of the way around the city. And then he enters back in, chapter 2 says, back into the at the valley gate. You think, what was he doing? Well, he was walking around with the few men that were with him, and he had his clipboard in front of him, or his clip scroll, I guess it would be, right? His clip scroll in front of him. And he was making notes, and he was drawing pictures, right? He was assessing the extent of the damage. He was identifying areas that needed more work than others. He was making a list of all the materials that they would need to bring in from the king's forest. He was developing a deployment strategy. He was making a list of the tools that would be required. He was identifying where supply posts were going to be set up. He was ensuring that pathways and roadways for the accessibility of supplies and the removal of waste were in place. He was establishing goals and targets for the workers, and he was trying to match the talent and the ability of the people with the tasks that had to be done in rebuilding the wall. And he was formulating a plan, and he was putting all that together. You know what he was doing? As he walked around the city of Jerusalem, he was inventing possibilities. He was inventing possibilities. He was going to show the people a way out. And that was something that they failed to see on their own. So, brothers and sisters, when we walk the perimeter of our ecclesia, when we view our ecclesia from the outside looking in, what do we see? What's the state of the walls? What tasks have been left undone? What's the prevailing attitude? Is it apathy or enthusiasm? And as a spiritual leader, what is your vision for your ecclesia, and what are you doing about it? And so Nehemiah was a strategist and a visionary. And coupled with that, he was able to motivate others. He was a motivator. Leadership is communicating to people their worth and potential so clearly that they come to see it in themselves. And when they see it, they begin to believe it. And once they believe it, they begin to demonstrate it. Leadership is communicating to people their worth and potential so clearly that they come to see it in themselves. And when they see it, they begin to believe it. And once they believe it, they begin to demonstrate it. Motivating others is the ability to inspire people to do more than those individuals thought possible of themselves. It's the ability to inspire people to do more than what those individuals thought possible of themselves. And Nehemiah was able to do that. And he does that at the end of chapter 2, doesn't he? Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 17, it says, "Then said I unto them, Ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come and let us build up the walls of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach." You know, the people themselves couldn't see the level of distress that they were in because they had spiritual tunnel vision, didn't they? And sometimes We have that problem in the ecclesia. We have this spiritual tunnel vision. And all the people got so used to stepping over the rocks and all of the rubble and winding their way through all those things that after a while they didn't see it anymore. Sometimes we can't see opportunities for growth and development in our ecclesia because we are so caught up in the ecclesial routine. Lamentations chapter 2 says, "Her prophets also find no vision from the Lord until Nehemiah came and gave them vision," right? Lamentations 2, verses 8 and 9. And in chapter 3 and verse 51, Jeremiah says, "You know, mine eye affects my heart. When I look at Jerusalem, my heart breaks." And if our eye and our heart are not connected, then the truth is only an academic exercise, isn't it? And so in verse 17 of Nehemiah chapter 2, notice the prepositions. Is preposition the right word? Yeah, all the we's and the us's. Notice how he addresses the people. You know, he could have said to the people, "You know, you're just a bunch of lousy good-for-nothings. You know, you've been here for 140 years and you hadn't lifted a single rock. What's wrong with you people?" You know, he could have said that, couldn't he? But he doesn't. He doesn't point the finger at them and say, "You have the problem." He says, "We have the problem. But we also have an opportunity." And so in verse 17, see what he says. "You see the distress that we are in. How Jerusalem lieth waits and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem that we be no more a reproach." That's servant leadership, isn't it? That's identifying yourself with the people. And he didn't want the people anymore to be a disgrace, which is what that word reproach means. He wanted to get rid of the apathy. You know, apathy is insidious, isn't it? Apathy we can't see in ourselves. We never can see apathy in ourselves. It always has to be pointed out by someone else. Someone else needs to point it out because we are blind to it in ourselves. And Nehemiah sees the apathy, but he also sees the opportunity. And Nehemiah is motivated by the opportunity. And ecclesial opportunities, when we can identify them and be open and honest with ourselves, they provide potential for growth. And so he tells them in verse 18. He says, "Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me." He would have told them about the 4 months that he was in prayer before God. And he would have related the experience of going in before the king. And he would have told them how scared he was to go in before the king. But yet by God's grace, the king showed favor unto him. And he would have read all the letters from the king to them and said, "Look at what he said. We can take anything we want from the king's forest. And look, he gave me all these myriads of men, these soldiers to come with me to make sure that everything's secure. And the king has done all this for us. It's incredible how the hand of God has worked with me and the king. And now we have the opportunity to take that and to rebuild the city because God's provided us the means." And he speaks in such a way so that the people themselves, what do they say at the end of verse 18? "Oh, let us rise up and build," is what the people say when Nehemiah is done. And so they strengthened their hands for this good work. Nehemiah's vision had now become the people's vision. Anybody heard of Sir Christopher Wren? Sir Christopher Wren was the architect that designed and built St. Paul's Cathedral. And apparently this is a true story, that there was one day he decided to go up to the site of the building to see the progress that had been made, and he came across two men. He asked the first man, who was sweaty and unhappy and obviously miserable, he asked him, "What are you doing?" The man answered with disdain, without lifting his head, "I'm breaking rocks. What do you think I'm doing?" And so he moves on and he goes to the second man. The second man was working more vigorously, and he had considerably more energy and enthusiasm, and he was working with a smile on his face. And he asked the man the same question, "What are you doing?" And the man paused in his work, pleased that Sir Christopher Wren had stopped to ask, and with elation he stated, "I'm building a cathedral." And it's interesting that the building started in 1670 and wasn't finished until the 1720s. And those two men would have never seen the finished product. But the second man could see that he was building a cathedral, and the first man, all he could see that he was breaking rocks. The second was happy to be part of something that was greater than himself. And Nehemiah was able to provide a vision which moved the people from a mindset of just breaking rocks to a mindset where they rise up and say, "We will arise and build." We're not building a cathedral, but we are building heavenly Jerusalem. And so in our ecclesia, what are we doing? Are we just breaking rocks? Or are we building the walls of something that will last through eternity? He was a strategist, and he was a motivator. And he was a positive communicator. You know, we spend greater than 90% of our day communicating. Communication is not just what we say. It's about how we conduct ourselves. It's our body language. It's what our nonverbal cues tell others about where we're at, as well as our speech. And how we do all that and how we communicate says as much about ourselves as the activity itself. And we often communicate without thinking. And we may think we're not communicating, but we're still doing it. And the way we communicate defines who we are. So what do our communication patterns tell others about ourselves? I'd like to take a few moments to look at the communication patterns of a spiritually astute individual, namely Nehemiah. And the first one is this, and there's four of them. The first thing is, and we established this, I think, on Monday, he first listens and then he prays. He listens objectively, he listens empathetically, and then he instinctively prays. He's a man that lived in prayer, right? And there's always that pattern. He listens first, and then he prays. That's the first pattern. He always speaks to God before he answers man. We saw that in Nehemiah chapter 2 and verses 4 and 5. We're not going to go back through that again. That's that quick, short prayer. Romans chapter 12 and verse 12 says, continue instant in prayer. Philippians 4 says, in everything by prayer. And Proverbs 3 says, in all thy ways acknowledge him. And in Nehemiah chapter 4 and Nehemiah chapter 6, which we're not going to take the time to go to, there was opposition that arose. In Nehemiah chapter 4, there was ridicule. And what did he do? He prayed and then went back to work. There were threats in Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 7 to 9. Physical threats. What did he do? He prayed and then went back to work. And then there was the offer of compromise. Come on, let's go meet in a neutral location. And let's work out a deal, right? In Nehemiah chapter 6. And he just simply says a prayer. This is one of his short little prayers. Right? He prays to God. And he just says three words. He says, strengthen my hands in Nehemiah chapter 6. He always speaks to God before he answers man. The third characteristic we just talked about this morning is he knows when to keep silence. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 says, there is a time to keep silence. And you know, sometimes in ecclesial life, we just need to keep our tongue, don't we? It's better not to say anything at times. It can cause more problems by blurting it out before we gather all the facts. Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. Keep the door of my lips. Whoso keepeth his mouth and his tongue keepeth his soul from troubles, Proverbs 21 says. And the fourth communication pattern we see is he always speaks positively and motivationally. We saw that in Nehemiah chapter 2. Proverbs 29 says, where there is no vision, the people perish. The word vision there means to see with the mind, and the word perish in the New King James Version is actually rendered cast off restraint. And when we don't have a vision, when we can't see with the mind, when we're just there breaking rocks, right, there's a tendency to cast off restraint. If we don't have a compelling mental picture, our spiritual motivation will wane. And other things will begin to creep in to occupy our time. And so Nehemiah sees the importance of motivating the people by giving them vision, to see themselves differently. So Nehemiah's communication patterns, right? He listens and then prays. He always speaks to God before he speaks to man. He knows when to keep silent. And he speaks positively and motivationally. But sometimes, you know, in our communication, sometimes we need to have that crucial conversation with somebody, don't we? Sometimes we need to confront them. There's times when we have to deal with conflict. And when we do that, we often wrestle with our own emotions, our own anger in those situations. And Nehemiah shows us how to do that. Turn to Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5, and we're not going to read all those verses because we're starting to run out of time, and I'm not going to be late today. Nehemiah chapter 5 in the first five verses, here's the scenario. The children of Israel, or the people of Jerusalem, come to him and they say to Nehemiah, our sons and our daughters need food in verse 2. We've mortgaged our lands, we've mortgaged our houses and our vineyards in order to buy food. And we have payments to make. They've borrowed money to pay the king's tribute against their lands. And they've borrowed that money off their brethren, and when they couldn't repay it, their own brethren were taking their sons and daughters into bondage as slaves and servants. So when Nehemiah finds that out, what's his reaction? Verse 6. He says, and I was very angry. And you could just see Nehemiah as he hears this story coming from his brethren, right? You can just see Nehemiah as his the veins start popping out in his neck, right? And he clenching his fist. and his blood pressure is going up. And you can see that he becomes incredibly enraged and angry when he sees how his brethren are treating their fellow brethren. So what does he do? I was very angry when I heard their cry in these words, he said in verse 6. And then in verse 7 he says, you want to highlight this in Nehemiah chapter 5. I consulted with myself. I consulted with myself. The NEB says, I mastered my feelings. What he was doing, wasn't he, was exercising his freedom to choose how he responded. You know, when we don't often, well, very rarely, if ever, I hope, we don't wake up in the morning and say, you know what? I think I'm going to be angry today. Usually, when we're angry, there's a stimulus, right? There's something that makes us angry. There's something that happens or somebody says something that makes us incredibly angry. And, you know, it's like, I use this example of starting the lawnmower, right? You pull the lawnmower and you pull it 20 times and the lawnmower won't go. And instead of pausing, right, and thinking about it for a minute, you give the lawnmower a kick. And then you have a big swollen toe as well as a lawnmower that doesn't work. So if you don't exercise that freedom to choose your response between the stimulus and how you respond, that's what happens. And when we react that way, when we treat, or if we use that principle, when how we treat people in the ecclesia, and we don't exercise our freedom to choose our response, 9 times out of 10 will respond in a manner that we'll later regret. And so Nehemiah teaches us to insert this pause between the stimulus and the response. And sometimes that pause is naturally there. Sometimes it just happens to be there. There's space. You know, you're not going to see the person for another 24 hours. Whatever the case may be, sometimes it's just naturally there. Sometimes, like Nehemiah did, we have to force fit it in between there. And we have to exercise ourselves to put a pause in there. That's when you count to 10, and that's when you decide you're going to leave and go out and go for a walk, right? You have to put that pause in there. But that's exercising your freedom to choose. And that's key in managing our emotions in the ecclesia and how we treat other people. And so he inserts the pause to give him some time to manage his emotions and react in a positive and forthright way. And I think when we manage our anger, there's really 5 steps in Scripture that Scripture says we should follow. The first one is we need to consciously acknowledge to ourselves that we're angry. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26 says, it's okay to be angry, just don't sin when you're angry. And it's possible to do that. We need to restrain our immediate response. That's when we insert the pause, right? Proverbs says, a fool gives full vent to his anger. People with good sense restrain their anger. A quick-tempered man does foolish things. That's when we don't insert the pause. And there's a quote, and I don't know where it's from, but speak when you're angry and you will make the best speech you will ever regret. And we've all made that speech, haven't we? The third step is seek to understand before making yourself understood, right? You may have heard that from work from, you know, Stephen Covey. But it's true and it's scriptural. That's why in James it says we need to be quick to listen and slow to wrath, slow to speak. And step number 4 is, once you've done all that, is to analyze your options. And there's really 2 options scripturally, isn't there? We either consciously decide to overlook the matter, and that's not storing your anger. It's releasing the anger to God and giving God the right to take revenge. Right? Revenge is God's prerogative. Proverbs 19 says, "The discretion of a man deferreth his anger, and it is his glory to pass over a transgression." So if we're going to take option number one, that doesn't mean that we keep that incident on inventory, right? And then the next time a similar incident comes up and says, "Ah, you know, brother X or sister Y, you know what, I got three things that you've done over the past 10 years, and here they are, in addition to the one that you've just done." That's not overlooking the matter. It's wiping that slate clean and giving it over to God. And we can do that. In some situations, that's the appropriate response. Or we lovingly confront the person, restoring such a one in the spirit of meekness. "If thy brother trespass against thee, rebuke him." And the word rebuke in that passage in Luke chapter 17, it means to set a weight upon. And when you rebuke that brother, really what you're doing, when you rebuke that brother or sister, you're really setting the weight back on them. You're saying, "Here's the situation, and here's how you made me feel, and here's how you made everybody else feel. Brother, what do you think you should do about it?" And you put the weight back on them. There's always a possibility you may have misunderstood. By confronting the person, there may be some clarification. But you have two options: to overlook or confront. And then you need to take constructive action. The goal is to always get to a point where you can forgive. That's the goal. So how does Nehemiah do? Step one, consciously acknowledge to yourself that you're angry. Verse 6, what does it say? "I was very angry." Restrain your immediate response. Nehemiah does that well, right? He removes himself. "I consulted with myself." Seek to understand before making yourself understood. He lays the problem out before the businessmen, his brethren, right? And he said, "Did I miss anything?" Verse 8, "They held their peace and they found nothing to answer." Nehemiah had it right. And so Nehemiah had two options. He could overlook the matter or lovingly confront. What does Nehemiah choose? He chooses to lovingly confront them. Verse 9, "It is not good what you do." And so he takes constructive action. He says, you need to restore everything that you've taken. You need to require nothing of your brethren. And you need to do that by oath. And then Nehemiah goes out and sets an example, and he feeds 150 people at his table at the end of Nehemiah chapter 5. That's how we manage our emotions positively in the ecclesia, in dealing with one another. Because we all have emotions. We all have anger. We all need to deal with it and teach ourselves to deal with it positively. And we're running out of time. I think we have about 2 minutes left. So we're going to go through this fifth one really quickly: managing oppositions. Sometimes we get opposition from inside the ecclesia, sometimes we get opposition from outside the ecclesia, but it's important that we learn how to handle it. Most of Nehemiah's opposition was from outside. There was grief given to him in chapter 2 and verse 10. They were ridiculed in chapter 2 and verse 19. There was indignation, intimidation, there was violence threatened, there was cunning craftiness and compromise that came at him. He dealt with the whole gamut of opposition. And how did he deal with that opposition? This was Nehemiah's strategy. If you go through all of those situations, and we're not going to take the time, we don't have it this morning to do that, the first thing he does in all the situations is he lets them know where they stand. For example, in chapter 2, at the end, after he makes his motivational speech, he says to those who were ridiculing him, he says, "You have no portion, no right, or no memorial in Jerusalem." It's very clear. No ifs, ands, and buts, right? He's not walking the middle line. It's very clear where they stand. In the face of verbal or physical confrontation, he's silent before the opposition. He doesn't respond. He doesn't elevate anything. He simply prays and continues to work. And in the face of craftiness or compromise, He refuses to meet them on their terms. He prays, and he continues to work. So, brethren and sisters, I think it's very clear. Nehemiah is a spiritual leader. He's a spiritual leader that we do well to emulate. He is a strategist, a motivator, a positive communicator. He manages his emotions. He's not afraid to confront. He has the spiritual courage to set things right. And he's able to manage opposition. Each of us in this room has the ability to be a Nehemiah. The question we need to ask ourselves as we leave Bible school is, are we the Nehemiah or the spiritual leader that our ecclesia needs us to be? Here.
You can't leave yet.
Brother Gary, excuse me, on behalf of the brothers and sisters and young people, we'd like to thank you and Sister Amy for all your efforts on our behalf. You summarized everything pretty well today in the spirit of Nehemiah, that we might take that spirit back to our ecclesias, the opportunities we have to build up and not tear down, to have a vision of the things that we need to work on as we await our Lord's return. So we really like to thank you
for
your efforts this week.
And thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to be with you. And I hardly knew anyone when I came here, and I feel like I know everyone now. So thank you for your warmth and your hospitality. And on behalf of my wife, Amy, and I, thank you very much. And maybe we'll see you next year.
Thanks. Sooner than that, you have a wedding, so.
Yeah.